Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 33 of the History Hotline and the last episode in our migration series. I am so excited. I'm sad because it's our final guest, but I'm so excited because this guest is just absolutely fantastic. And this guest actually comes highly recommended. Her fantastic friend actually messaged me and was like, you need this girl on your podcast. And in our literal 10-15 minute chat of introduction that we've just had, I completely understand why she said that, because I'm already just like fired up and ready to go. Gems will be dropped, you know, tables will be shaken, flipped and turned today. So I hope you are ready. Today's episode is going to be looking at the presence of Nigerian communities in Britain, and we are joined by the fantastic and wonderful Abigail Fagbolagun. Welcome.
Hi.
Oh, hello, hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, everyone. Oh, I'm so excited, guys. I'm so excited. I love history.
Thank you for being here for number one.
Thank you for having me.
No, honestly. So, I'm going to give everybody a little bio. We're going to introduce you and then we're going to get straight in and ask you some questions, because I'm sure everybody wants to know a little bit about you before you drop all your gems on us today. So, Abigail, she studied history, of course, at the University of Essex, and looked at Nigeria, obviously. That's why she's here talking about that today. But specifically, how did Nigerians live and adapt to life in the UK, looking at the 1960s to the early 2000s? And obviously, you might be thinking, oh, early 2000s, is that history? Well, yes, it is history, because it didn't happen today. It's not in the present. But also, you have to remember that not all kind of the waves of black people migrating to this country happened in the 40s and 50s, like the Windrush generation. So I think it's quite interesting to take this perspective from a little bit later on in what we would look at normally as history, shall we say. Abigail has studied extensively, you know, looking at different themes across history, such as obviously migration and race. She's also been able to look at a lot of British history, so she's going to be able to provide a lot of that good context. Something which I've never really studied too much, really, British history, but you know, we've got Abigail for that. She's also been able to study African-American history in quite a lot of depth, looking at things like hip-hop culture in America historically, poetry and music in regards to American slavery in the South, and kind of things related to that. So we've got a very well-versed speaker and guest today who can speak about so many different things. We will be obviously focusing on migration in Nigeria, but you know, if you want Abigail back to be talking about hip-hop and all these other fantastic things, you know, just let me know. I take requests and I am already excited for what we will be talking about today. In the first like 10 minutes of us speaking, Abigail has told me about 4 random historical facts. Now, I thought I was like a bit of a history nerd, which obviously I am, because I'm really here with the whole podcast. But yeah, Abigail has facts from far and wide. So do you want to give us one now, just so we can launch in?
My first random enough is that Henry VIII was actually 6'1" in a time where most men were actually 5'5". So he was like a giant, and he actually wasn't a glutton. Like when we look at Henry VIII, we think of someone who was always eating and fat and whatever, but he wasn't. Like, I don't know why history has presented, I'm telling you.
You've shattered everything I've ever learned about the Tudors.
Horrible histories have got to like confirm some stuff, because
in portraits,
He was a bit big, but he wasn't like a glutton. You know what I mean? And he was serious. Like sometimes you think of him as unserious because he had so many wives and
he's a serious
guy. And he was tall. So can you imagine most men being 5'5" and he's out here 6'1"? Every woman's dream.
Wow.
When I found that out, I was like, but the thing is, a lot of the history we learn it from media. Do you know what I mean? And everybody wants to watch something that's interesting. So when we're watching a movie about Henry VIII and he's a glutton, you're thinking, okay.
You can hate him a bit more.
You can, yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So yeah, that's my random fact.
Wow. So let's just have a talk about you. So, you know, I've introduced you, but have a chance to introduce yourself. So who are you?
Okay, guys, I'm Abigail Fagbolligan. I'm 23. I graduated in 2020 with this whole pandemic because I did a year abroad in America.
Wow.
So I did a four-year course, which was absolutely great. That's where I was able to do hip-hop culture. Like, doing a year abroad was the best thing for me because when it comes to history, it's good to have perspective.
Mm.
And that literally gave me a lot of perspective in terms of the fact that, let's say when we talk about World War II, right, or the World Wars, we have a start date for Europe. But when you think about America, America has another start date. So you might, if you're American, you might actually say, no, the World War didn't start at this time. It started at another time. So having been able to go on my year abroad was really good. So yeah, I've just graduated, looking for jobs. The job market is literally like thinner than, I don't know, me when I was young. It's so hard right now, but
you'll get
doing that.
You will.
Exactly.
Do you want to stay in history? Is this
definitely
this
like that's my thing?
Yeah.
Because like I'm trying to like do history forever. Do you get what I mean? Like I want to do different things.
Again.
I want to teach. Do you get what I mean? Like history is my passion. You know, some people have a career and then they have a passion. It's like ours is interlinked.
It's
like I love history on the side.
Sometimes I think it's not a good thing, but I do. What else can we do?
I just love it, do you know what I mean? And I want to pursue specifically Black British history for now, and then just basically
Definitely.
Do Black history. But I love wars, so I might dabble in that as well.
Right. Okay, tell me, what is your favourite historical time period, if any?
I love like I was saying, the slavery period of America. Like, I find that really interesting because of the fact that these are human beings who went through slavery. And when we look at the transatlantic slave trade, we're not looking at something we've seen before. Like, this was very systematic. Do you know what I mean? And for me, my favorite part of it is like slave narratives and like stories about that time, because we get to see how these people felt. Do you know what I mean? And they were taken from one culture to another. And that's what I find fascinating. Like, because I think of my parents, literally, they are British, but like completely not having their language, completely not having their accent.
Definitely.
Like, do you know what I mean?
Just
like,
for context,
the all the
sorry
time.
If someone didn't get this. Abigail's obviously British Nigerian, so.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mention that. I'm British Nigerian, I'm Yoruba.
Fantastic.
So, yes, if that makes
sense. Yeah, definitely.
That's my favourite time.
I hear that. So, your research interests, you've said, you're looking at Black history specifically. When you say Black British history, or, you know, other kinds of Black history, do you want to carry on looking at Nigerian people or more, you know, I don't know, different groups,
different
countries?
In general, I would say because the way the Black British community is, we're all from different places, but we're all in this, do you know what I mean? We're all in this
I think especially with young people, there is a Black British youth,
exactly,
not movement, because we're not protesting anything, but there's a community, there's a sense of us,
pride,
and
that I don't know if the previous generations had. Like, maybe they were just fighting for their lives, but now it's like, we are here. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can't tell, stop asking me where I'm from, ninja. Like, even though I am proud to be Nigerian, don't ask me where I'm from when I tell you I'm from London. Do you know what I mean? Because I know you're trying to dig deeper to find out where this melanated skin comes from. But so for me, I do want to do Nigerian history, but more Black British lot, definitely, because I think it's going to be it would be easier for me to just do all of us. And then I guess if I'm going to specific places, then I would do like, okay, the Nigerian church, for example, or the Caribbean church.
Definitely. That's the thing. Black British history doesn't have to be a group of people. You can look at themes. You can look at places.
Exactly.
You can look at spaces. You can look at activism. You can look at anything.
Exactly.
So, fantastic. Okay. Before we get into our main discussion, we're going to look at, you know, like a mini history of Nigeria and why Nigerian people ended up in Britain. Do you want to give us another fun fact?
Some people do know that braids, that people would keep food in their braids.
During slavery.
So yeah, that's a fun fact. So when people just talk about braids, like it's just like braids is more than a protective style. Braids is, do you know what I mean? Yeah, it's like literally our culture.
And it was a lifesaver.
Yeah, it was a lifesaver, I'm telling you. So, and people had long hair, so.
Yeah, and braid maps into hair. They're Underground Railroad.
Yes, exactly.
Braid maps into the hair or paths to freedom.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay. Now, let us think about Nigeria. Go on, set the scene. What is the history of Nigeria? I'm going to pretend I know nothing. I know very little, honestly.
Okay, so we know that the British have been in Africa for a while now. And so slavery was abolished in the 1800s, the late 1800s. But we see that the British, well, the European powers always wanted more than just enslaved people or gold. They wanted more. They wanted land. And so we see the British come back. So basically, we really see them take control in 1851. They take over the colony of Lagos. Basically, there was an uncle that was in power. He was taken out of power and his nephew took place, right?
Okay.
And the uncle wanted to go back into power. And so basically, the British help him take his kingdom back. And so in 1851, they come, there's a little war, you could call it, and he regains power. And then in 1861, the British basically forced the, they call them Oba, which is king, the king of Lagos, to sign this treaty, basically saying, we're going to take control of Lagos. And so he does it. He doesn't want to, but he does it.
Yeah.
And then over the next few years, we see that basically the British government, or even like the monarchy, gives permission to companies to take over bits of Nigeria. Yes. So we see different companies. You may have heard of the Royal Niger Company. Sometimes we even talk about the Royal Indian Company when it comes to India. So there's a lot of royal companies going around to different countries. And so we basically see that going on. So there are different companies that basically take control of different parts of Nigeria. And then basically the Royal Niger Company did something that the British didn't like. And so they sold their holdings to the British. Okay, so in 1899, the Royal Niger Company sold their holdings to the British for £865,000. So the British basically bought the bought Nigeria from the British, which is weird.
Just to say as well, sorry to cut you, that 865,000 in 1899 is 46,407,250 in today's money. So
guys, like that's crazy. So from there we basically see the British take over. And then at this point Nigeria wasn't Nigeria is today. Do you get what I mean? It was just places. And so the British brought the south and the north together and they created Nigeria. And
they forced them together, right? This is different
ethnic
groups. They created
the lines. Yeah, so we have in Niger actually, we have over 400 ethnic groups. Obviously they all come out of one ethnic group, but there's so many. So that's when it comes to looking at Africa, when you look at the lines of every single country, the people on those lines on the borders are going to have such similar culture, because truly you could have moved those lines how many kilometers and you would have been Nigeria, you know, which is,
and now you're classed as Nigerian, but before you were whatever your ethnic group was,
you were tribe. Exactly.
Or...
Tribes were most important. That's one thing to highlight when it comes to looking at Africa. You would look at tribes. You wouldn't look at, because even now we still, tribes are very important in Africa. Do you get what I mean? And so, so in the 50s, people have always not liked the British being there, because people have pride. African people have pride. And so it's like, how can someone take over our land? So in 1958, the British finally agreed that, okay, we're going to give you, you're going to give your land back. You're going to be Nigeria. And so on the 1st of October, 1960, Nigeria became independent. And so that's where we start to see Nigerian migration to the UK.
Okay. That is like a whistle-stop tour. I like that.
Yeah, guys, go and research. It's a lot to, like,
of course. And this podcast is always just a starting point for further research. Yeah, there is never going to be an episode where everything is said in one place.
It's impossible. There's so much.
Honestly. And even just from, you know, my own, like, little bits of reading here and there, like, even pre-1899, you know, pre that point where, enslaved people were being taken and shipped over to the Caribbean and the Americas. There's a whole history of that as well.
There's so, like, much.
As West African people, we are, and I say we, yes, I'm Jamaican, but we're everywhere because we were taken from these regions of Africa
100%.
And dropped off on many different stops on these slave ships. And so, you know, this is a very, very, very big and I think important history as well, not just specifically Nigeria, but Africa generally. I think it's important when we do Black history, and it's something I've always wanted to do more but just not felt able to. We need to go back to Africa to understand our roots, our culture, everything our started. Heritage. It's where it all started. It's who we are as Black people.
Exactly.
Into this. So let us move on. Let us not dwell too long.
My gosh, do you want me to give you a random fact? I can give you a random fact about slavery, which I find really disturbing, though. So, as you said, Africans were taken to the Americas, well, whether that is the USA that we know today, and Latin America. And in USA, the masters would take more care of their enslaved people because they wanted their money's worth. But in the Caribbean, the average age that a man would die in the Caribbean at the beginning of slavery was 24 years old. Aware that they could just go back to Africa and get another group of people and enslave them, which I just think is correct. Like, these are human beings. The only thing that's different about us is that some of us are more pigmented than other people. That's why I always say that race, we all know that race doesn't make sense because it doesn't account for all people. When we talk about African people, talk about them being Black. When we talk about people from Europe, we talk about them being white. How can you only have something that accounts for two people? It's just absolutely. All of it is anyway crazy.
It is phenomenal. Absolutely.
It is.
But definitely. Thank you again for the fun fact. Although I think your facts are coming less fun. They're facts, but I don't know.
They're fun anymore. They are. They're not fun.
Slavery is not fun.
They're sad facts.
They are sad facts. Abigail's sad facts. Tune in. Thinking about Nigeria, of course, positioned in West Africa. We left kind of our little last point in the 60s where, you know, Nigeria has independence October 1st, 1960. And so how does independence look, but what does that look like? Is it going well? What's happening? I feel like you've got regions and nations pushed together, tribes pushed together and forced to be one. I'm sure the British government have put parliament in place and put their political structures in place and their education system. So, what does that look like?
So, as you said, like, the British have been here for a while. So we see a lot of Christianity in Nigeria. And like you said, there have been parliaments. There are British people who live in Nigeria who are basically controlling Nigeria, but they are leaving now. And so the Nigerian government start to send people to the UK on scholarships, on four-year scholarships to gain education so that they can take over these posts.
Okay.
And so that's why we started to see Nigerians come to the UK.
As students with purpose. So,
and
not like with the Windrush generation, as, you know, workers that then fall into unskilled labour because they can't get any other jobs to rebuild Britain post-war. These people are coming with a purpose of getting an education, with money, I'm assuming.
Funding, yeah.
With the intention of going home.
And they came, but Nigeria was at a place where the UK wasn't where you wanted to be anyway.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? There wasn't much that was appealing to you from Britain. Like, the British were in Britain, like, where are you going? The British are in Niger. The British, like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so we see a lot of people coming and going.
Yeah.
It was no, like, I want to stay. It was like, peace out. But obviously there were people who would stay. Some people would fall in love here. Decide that, you know what, this is the country for them. And so from that period, that's my research showed me that 60s, that's where we really see the influx of Nigerians coming into the UK.
That's quite interesting.
Small, but,
because I don't know if you ever watched Desmond's.
Yeah, I love it.
And I know if anyone has watched it, the character of Matthew, he's not Nigerian. I can't remember what country he's from. It's not Nigeria, though. But he comes as a student and he's just doing courses and courses and courses all throughout the seasons. Whereas you have the Guyanese like barbershop workers, Pork Pie, the Peckham Prince, who's and Desmond himself, who are working, you know, they've come at an older age, they've got families now, they can't go anywhere. Even though Desmond's dream is to go home one day, like, he can't do that because he's financially trapped. Whereas with Matthew's character, it seems like he could go at any... Is it Matthew or Michael?
At any time.
Matthew.
One Michael's of them. It's an M.
Yeah. Okay. He can go back at any time, absolutely. And I think that's very interesting when we think about the kind of profile of people of this migration and what that then means in terms of maybe even class for the future.
Yes.
If you've got people that are coming with degrees or that are getting degrees from British universities, not from universities that aren't trusted by the British.
Yeah.
And so there's a difference there when we're thinking about potentially comparing different groups of migrants.
Exactly.
In this country.
Which is amazing that they were even able to capture that in a TV program.
Right. TV in the 90s, I'm sorry, but it was really doing the things that today should be doing.
If we even start, we're going to be here forever.
We will be forever. But I just want to say, since it happened literally today, the day we're recording, Steve McQueen's Small Axe has just been nominated for 15 BAFTAs.
Oh, 15.
As in different actors, actresses, producing, directing, all that kind of stuff. So
that is amazing.
I feel like we're getting back to a golden age of Black British TV.
I hope so.
I pray so. Anyway, so continuing on. Not most countries in Africa, a lot of countries in Africa and a lot of countries around the world, let's be honest, have this thing that happens called a civil war.
Yes.
Now, we're not going to go into the whole depths of the civil war because no civil war is simple. We know this. The American won long enough. British have had a civil war. Everybody had a civil war. So the Nigerian civil war, though, does that have an impact on migration?
From what I found, no. When I first went into this research, I went into it as people came because of the war. Do you know what I mean? And I remember I was on the phone to my friend's dad, and he was like, no, that's not what happened. And I was like, and he was like, yes, people came because of independence. So when you do look at migration, you hardly see people coming because of that civil war.
Yeah.
Especially because you could say it was a small part of Nigeria fighting the other part. It was more so the Igbo people. So we actually don't see that having an impact.
That's interesting. But
the Nigerian civil war is very important. The Biafra war.
Okay. Fantastic, thank you. And I'm thinking then, okay, when was the big wave then? Because 1960s, as you said, people coming as students, a lot returning home, but we have a huge Nigerian community in this country, especially in London. London actually has, from the 2011 census actually, 114,718 Nigerian born, so that's not even second generation. In their population, the borough of Suffolk, even though it's South
York, which is crazy.
Being the biggest. So South London, obviously seeing the kind of mass of that migration, and then other regions kind of following on. So what happened in the 80s then that led to this wave?
I believe there's like cultural and like government like beef, I would say, with the people. I guess this is when you really see the Nigerian government doing higgy haga. They've been doing higgy haga for years, but here's where we see it. And so in the 80s and 90s, we see, I think it also has to do with oil. There's so many different things.
Of course.
We see loads of Nigerians. Actually, in the 90s, the Nigerian population increased by 86%.
Wow.
So we see a massive, like, do you know what I mean? Like, we see, like, there's more people. And literally, like you said, most Yoruba people who migrate actually are found in South London. Wow. Like when you look all over the world, which is crazy.
Yeah, definitely.
So I'm so happy I grew up in South London. I'm not
that. But also, I feel like Yoruba are the dominating kind of numbers when it comes to Nigeria's migrating here.
In the UK, yes.
But are they the biggest group in Nigeria?
No, they're not. They're one of the... They're actually small. When we look at...
small but loud.
Small but loud. That's why I love Yoruba people. I always say if I wasn't Yoruba, I would have an issue with us. Like, you're so loud.
Of course.
But Fulani / Hausa people are the biggest tribe in Nigeria. Okay. Like, majority.
Yeah.
And then we see other tribes in Yoruba. We see Igbo. Mm-hmm. We see Benin people. There are so many different tribes.
Of course.
But when it comes to, I guess, the UK, Yoruba people are so loud because when it comes to migration, my research has basically told me the research that I've seen when it comes to Nigerian migration is Yoruba people come to the UK,
yeah,
Igbo people go to the US, wow, and Hausa people / Fulani people, when they do migrate, go to Muslim countries,
right? Because they're Muslim. UAE,
because they're Muslim, it makes sense for them to go.
Definitely. Why would they come to Britain to do Islamophobia and racism?
Exactly. Do you know what I mean? And sometimes we forget how important faith and religion is to people, and it has a big impact on people's lives. And so that's why I guess Yoruba people are so loud here. But even that was back in the day, but even now, when I look at Nigerians in the US, I see mostly Igbo people.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah. Why do you think then there's a difference with the Yoruba people and the Igbo people that go from, do you know what I mean, go to the US and
I have no idea, really. I really don't know. But it does have an impact on Nigerian faith in the UK also. Like,
of course.
Everything interlinks.
Yes, definitely.
But I have no idea why Igbos are going to
America. Well, then I guess sometimes it's the same thing with any group of people. And instead of lumping groups of people from Nigeria as Nigerians, we should be looking at it in separate.
You have to.
Because Jamaicans... probably, I'm sure there's regions in Jamaica, even though it's such a tiny island, that all went to a certain part of the UK, maybe Handsworth, maybe Brixton, maybe Tottenham. And so the same thing is happening there. But because we have, and by we I mean British people, have said, Nigeria, you are one clump, we are just like, oh, well, everyone just came to England, when it's actually, there's, nuances, you know, there's complexities.
Yes, exactly.
That are definitely not one.
We're not all the same.
Black people are not one. Caribbean people are not one. African people are certainly not one. Nigerian people are not one.
And then Yoruba people, when I was doing my dissertation, my dad was walking me through. So I'm from Osun State in Nigeria. Okay. So that's Osun.
Yeah.
And my dad was walking me through the Ijesha people, Elesha people. I was thinking,
There's more of us.
There's more. Like, the older you get, it's funny because when I was younger, I was just Nigerian. Now I'm a bit older, I'm Yoruba. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And not that I'm not Nigerian anymore, but I'm just digging deeper.
Absolutely.
And the older we get, you dig deeper. And even when I was doing research for my dissertation, interviewing people, I found out that tribalism was a massive thing back home that I just didn't really know about.
It is. So, and I think I feel like when I hear about it, maybe as an outsider, I hear it as being quite a divisive thing.
Unfortunately, kind of like race.
Yeah, because it is,
even though it's hard to compare anything to race, I think, because race, it's just not even, it's just so much. But because when I interviewed somebody, she said that even looking for a job in places, so she's Igbo, and when she would go to places that weren't Igbo, they would hire the person, let's say she was in the Yoruba part, they would hire the person who was Yoruba because they didn't want to hire someone who was Igbo. But then again, I couldn't necessarily say that's the whole of Nigeria because I haven't been to Nigeria, and that's someone's experience, and that was that back in the day.
Yeah,
so definitely. I think tribes will always have something when it comes to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at, even when we look at Cameroon and we look at the English speakers and the French speakers, I still blame the British though for all the tribalism.
But they drew lines on a map with no regard to where people, forget even drawing lines with regard. They went there. Who told?
That's the maddest thing. As in, imagine going into someone's home and being like, okay, this is now mine. Whatever you make, you give to me.
Take all the food, all the natural resources, all the plants growing, and take some people as well and ship them off to another country.
Exactly. And say that you're here to civilize us and you're here to bring Christianity and faith. And not to say that there's anything wrong with faith at all. Come on, I'm a Christian. But don't hide, don't hide behind something. You know what I mean? And that's
don't do bad, evil, corrupt things in the name of God.
That's what they would do, but that's another podcast.
I think so too. Definitely. Okay, right. So what we are here to talk about today is then, you know, and you know, and now I hate to say it, but Nigerians, quote unquote, in Britain. What does that culture look like? We've said Yoruba people are loud. That's what you said, not me. And nobody come for me. Abigail's
Yoruba
word.
People are loud, guys. We can be loud and we can be quiet, like all people.
So, what are our thoughts? What are your findings, should we say? What does Nigerian culture look like in Britain? And also, we're looking at it in a different way that we look at the Windrush. And I'm sorry to keep comparing, but
it's, I guess,
a base level of understanding for most listeners. You know, Nigerians aren't the first black people in Britain. So maybe some of the legwork is done by earlier Caribbean communities and earlier African people that came. You know, we haven't looked at any other countries in Africa yet on this podcast who might have come earlier than Nigerians. So that legwork is kind of
a bit earlier, actually.
What was that, sorry?
Ghanaians might have been here a little bit earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And maybe different other countries that were colonised by the British. Yeah. So, yeah, what does Nigerian culture look like in Britain? Is it different to back home? Is it, you know, easy? Is it simple? You know, go on, talk me through it.
Okay, so I always love talking about culture in different places because, oh my gosh, I just love it because you can study this from a historical perspective. Yeah. You can study this from, I think it's called anthropology when you study human beings. Because when I was doing my dissertation and I was looking at assimilation, I was looking at some people, so there's different definitions or even words that can explain the way people assimilate. Some people come to the UK and decide that the British culture is what is going to be their culture. Mm-hmm. Some people reject British culture and be like, Nigerian culture is all I'm going to have.
Yeah.
Some people mix and some people just don't even do nothing. Mm-hmm. Whatever comes, that comes.
Yeah.
So when we look at Nigerian culture in the UK, I had three chapters, livelihood and school, faith and then access to home.
Okay.
And so basically I was just looking at Nigerian culture in the UK, or maybe what Nigerians even came to, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the biggest thing that I found was faith.
Yeah.
That was a massive part, that and still is a massive part of Nigerian culture.
Definitely.
In the UK. Like, I meet people and I'm like, what church did you grow up in?
Yeah.
Like, what church did you grow up in? Or what mosque did you grow up in? Do you know what I mean? So most people, if you know someone who's Nigerian, they probably grew up in church.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And so also when we look at that, we see that Yoruba people are Pentecostal Christians, and Igbo people are usually Catholics.
Yeah.
Which all has to do with colonialism as well, and what the British done, where the British went. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah.
And so my first chapter, like I said, I was looking at livelihood and schooling, and like I said, people came over to learn. Some people started to come over just to get an education. They didn't really know if they were going back, if they were staying.
Yeah.
And one of my most interesting findings, I kind of knew before, was this thing called farming.
Okay.
So this is where Nigerians, would foster off their children to white families outside of London for a few years while they studied. Because obviously people always say it takes a village to raise a child. And when we look at Africa, when we look at the Caribbean, this is really how they were doing it.
Yeah.
But a lot of people were coming with no family. Do you know what I mean? And some people literally got pregnant and found out that they were on their own.
Mm-hmm.
So these students would farm their children to these families.
Mm.
And some people would stay for 2-3 years while their parents got their degree, but some people would stay for longer. Some people never saw their parents again. So when we talk about farming, it's something that's a bit difficult because a lot of farming went well, but a lot of it didn't. And there's even a case of a young girl who died in the care of her foster parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so some people would go through a system. I believe the government actually helped out, but some people would just go off, look, my friend recommended this woman, I'm going to give my child to this woman. And they would pay these families to look after their children. There's a movie called Farming and another movie called The Last Tree. Both of them are actually really good movies to understand farming, and both of them are real. Yeah, The Last Tree and Farming the movie, they're both different perspectives. You get farming literally runs you through a child that was completely left in, you could say, wasn't completely, but he grew up in Britain, like his parents had come back for him. And then The Last Tree kind of takes you on the journey of a person who has been through farming and how do I get back into normal life?
Yeah.
Because a lot of these people didn't know they were black. Like, race is one of those things. You've grown up with white people, you know something is different about you, but you can't pinpoint it.
Or you can't verbalize it. You don't have the words, the language.
Because nobody else can verbalize it for you. And so by 1964, so this is only 4 years after independence, we see 1,743 children fostered.
Mm-hmm.
In these, but these are only official numbers. We don't know about the people who did private fostering.
Of course.
Farming is crazy because a lot of people don't know that this happened.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't know that people just couldn't handle it. One of my interviewees, she just said she couldn't handle working, looking for a job, schooling and looking after her son. So she fostered her kid out, and he still remembers, even though he left at 2 years old, he still remembers her. She was nice. And a lot of people still go back. And so, yeah, that was a massive part of my findings. And then, like I said, faith was a big part of that. And it wasn't just that you would go to church or mosque and worship God and then leave. It was so much more than that. And so, like I said, there are more Christians in the UK, Nigerian Christians, than there are Muslims, even though majority of Nigerians are actually Muslim.
Yeah.
So in the UK, we only see about 9% of Nigerians being Muslim, and the majority then are Christian, and we have some people that are atheists.
Yeah.
But even that is hard to find because of that. But we also have people who are, you don't see it so much, but people who basically still believe in Nigerian religion, even though you can't really call it religion, it's so hard to break. When we look at religion, we look at certain, like, there are rules, regulations, if that makes sense. I don't have to say rules and regulations, but when we look at Yoruba religion, to be specific, it isn't really like religion. It's kind of not free-flowing, but
like a belief system.
A belief system, yes. And so there's so much with it. And that's why we even see it continue, I guess, as we like go through slavery.
Yeah.
We see a lot of it. But it's much more, you know, when it comes to religion, like I said, rules and regulations, when we talk to Christians, Muslim, it's like bang, bang, bang. No, I can't be half Muslim, half Christian.
Mm-hmm.
But when we look at African religion or African faith, even when it came to slavery, and Black people were okay with accepting Christianity because they was just like, we're just going to mix it in.
Yeah.
Do you get me? And so even when it came to burials, for example, in Black America during slavery time, they would have Christianity in that burial, but they would also do what their ancestors did.
Yeah.
So they kind of mixed. Yep. So that's why I say it's more like I would say it's deeper in a way, but it's like very like relaxed. Like we're not gonna be for you, if that makes sense. So we see a little bit of that in the UK, but not majority. Okay. Hard to find evidence of that. So yeah, like church for me especially was a big thing because you would meet people and then you would go to their weddings. Like it was how people got to know each other. So coming to the UK from Nigeria or from wherever you were, and you found a faith hub, it was perfect because then you could get a job. Mm-hmm. You could meet someone, your pastor probably knew people in the community.
Yeah.
People could support you, wanted to open a business. We see a lot of Nigerian business owners actually in the UK.
Yeah.
If people want, you know, like it's free advertising. You go
to church, exactly. And you've got a community that are wanting to support you.
To support you, exactly.
As Christians and as fellow Nigerians.
And exactly that kind of what you're offering. So, yeah,
which is how community is formed.
Is formed, exactly. And that's how we see Nigerians function in the UK. My research took me to Manchester as well, but nowhere else, really.
Yeah. So, thinking about church and it being a huge part of Nigerian culture in the UK because of the fact that, you know, as you said, so many people that came from Nigeria would have been Christian and set up community in the church. Were there specific churches, denominations, because I know Nigerians are probably like, church being Catholic, but you know, these specific churches in the community, what kind of churches were they?
So like I was saying before, Yoruba people are Pentecostal Christians usually, which is an extension of the Protestant church, and then we see Igbo people being Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we look at churches in the UK, there's specific churches like CAC, which is the church I grew up in, Christ Apostolic Church, which was founded in Nigeria in 1940, in the 1940s or 1900s.
Yeah.
So by 2009, they had over 500,000 worshippers in the UK. We also see the Redeemed Christian Church of God, which is a massive church, like every Nigerian knows about Redeemed. Mm. And then there's KICC, which is Kingsway International Christian Centre. Yeah. So these are very popular churches that we see Nigerians going to during the 80s, the early 2000s, and even now. I meet people and be like, what CAC did you go to? Do you get what I mean? Or like, we've all been to a Redeemed church. So these churches were very important for the culture, for meeting people, whether you were really, really like about your relationship with Christ or not.
Yeah.
These places were very, very important. And like you said, Southwark like has a lot, like even now you can go to South, like Peckham, in fact, there are so many churches.
Wow.
And a fun fact actually is that
another one.
Southwark has the biggest concentration of African Christians outside of Africa.
Wow.
So it would be Africa number one, and then number two wouldn't just be London, it would be Southwark, South London. Do you know how crazy that is?
That's as in the biggest
populate, like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you grew up in Peckham, if you know family that in Peckham or like South London, you know that you can pass so many different churches. We see the impact that British Nigerians have had on not only their culture in the UK, mm-hmm. but on South London.
Yeah.
Do you get what I mean? On Peckham, like when we look at the hairdressers, yeah. like so many Nigerians own these hairdressers. Like there's even a part of Peckham next to Asda, if you know about Asda, and like, let's say you're walking towards like Camberwell,
mm-hmm.
there's a bit that like I like to call Lagos,
yeah.
because it's like it's just Nigerian shops.
Yeah.
Even though gentrification is real, but white people have been in South for years. But anyways, there's like random like white shops that, but you can yeah. get like everything you need, and that's one thing that I loved about growing up in South London.
Yeah. Right. Let us quickly talk about, I don't mean to rush it, but access to home.
No, it's fine.
And then yes. we will have said all we have to say about Nigeria.
All we have to say.
So yeah, I guess stay tuned for the next 5, 10, 15 maybe minutes. And then
do you know what, access to home is very, it's just your norm. Like mm-hmm. access to home just talks about the access you have to home.
And so home being Nigeria.
Home being Nigeria.
Yeah.
So like I said, my question was, how did Nigerians live and adapt within the UK?
Mm-hmm.
Having access to home helped them.
Yeah.
So my chapter is basically broken down into communication.
Yeah.
So we talk about letters being sent. We talk about phone calls.
Yeah.
It's so funny because when you're watching Nollywood movies, you always see people, if it's like a movie in the village,
mm-hmm.
someone will go to the person who has a phone, you pay, then you call the person wherever you're trying to call.
Yeah.
And that's basically what a lot of people would do to communicate with people back home.
Mm-hmm.
Then another thing we have is food. The access to food Fantastic. Gives you access to home.
Now we're talking.
God, I'm telling you, like when I was interviewing one of my friend's mum, actually, she was talking about the fact that she was able to eat the food that she ate in her village, yeah. that she ate at home, like that made her feel like better. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, okay, I don't have people who are my Nigerian and who are my next door neighbors, yeah. but the fact that I have access to food.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talk about culture, the first thing we really talk about is always food.
Definitely.
Do you know what I mean? Okay. Because we kind of all have access to that. When it comes to music, some people are deaf, like they can't hear music.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But like one of the things we have access to, all of us, is food. You have to eat.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And so literally having that taste is so good. It's so important. Like, but yeah, the fact that they were able to go to shops, markets, like all of those things helped people have access to home.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also look at media. We know about like Ben TV, like watching Nollywood, like people would watch it on cassettes because obviously there weren't many CDs. Yeah. You know? So all of these things help a person get situated in a place. Even when we go to university, we take things that remind us of our home, whether that's your one pillow or that teddy that you've had for 10 years that you ain't washed that might have COVID. Those things make us feel at home.
Infected.
So, yeah.
Definitely. Okay. So,
yeah, that's literally access to home. Access to home was just, it was a small chapter because it's something that I guess even if you were studying people who are Asian, you would have a chapter like that because it's really important to look at.
Right. Let us wrap up this episode with our closing words. So, Abigail, where shall we find you?
Yeah.
Plug your socials, plug anything you want to plug at this point, and then we will wrap up.
I'm on Instagram, abigael_XO. I have Twitter, but I can't give you my Twitter because I just tried to sit on there. But yes, if you follow me on Instagram, that would be great because, like, hopefully by the grace of God, soon I'm gonna set up a website because I just want to continue researching. Because I feel like once you graduate, you have and you want to be a historian, you can't just stop that way.
Yeah,
you have to continue to do research. So I want to like I was saying, my big thing is Black British, like youth. I guess youth actually stops at 24, but I want to go further than that.
Younger adults.
So I basically want to look at the second generation of all of us. Do you get what I mean? And obviously for the for Caribbeans, that would be maybe third or fourth generation.
Yeah, we really do numbers out here.
I just want to look at us, bro, literally. Yeah. So I just want to look at us. So that's definitely what I'm... This summer, actually, I need to get myself a camera. I'm just going to take pictures of people in general, but specifically Black people, and just have that, like, and in 10 years' time, I'm going to come up with a book the summer archive. After quarantine.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, pictures are so important. Like, I love when I see pictures of, like, Black people, like, back in the day, or back in the, like, even in the 90s or 80s. I just love it. It's great. Just like, look at them in Britain.
Definitely.
Gigani.
Indeed. Yeah. So, thank you so much for this episode. It's been fantastic. I've learned so much. I think Nigeria's history, Nigerian culture building, community building in Britain. Audience, obviously, you're still listening, and I'm sure you feel the same way. This is the end of our migration series, and I just feel like we finished with such a high point. We might have to reload it. We might have to reload the series. I need to look at more countries in Africa specifically, because as we've said, it is the beginning.
Ghana would be such a good place.
Of course, Ghana. I've really wanted to look at some of the countries colonized by the French, but that's actually about a year of reading I need to do about French colonization before I can even dip my toe. So for now, this is what we have presented, our migration series from the History Hotline with our final guest, our final fantastic guest, Abigail. Thank you so much for being on the episode today.
Thank you for having me, guys. I hope you learned loads of stuff, and follow me or check
absolutely and I'll plug all her pages on the social media posts, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, all that good stuff, so you can find her, and I'll plug her website when we get there, so yeah, you'll definitely be able to continue, and we're all gonna hope to see Abigail writing these books, publishing these articles, blogs in the future.
Hopefully books that people, not that people read, but you know, sometimes there are history books that only
I can't do that.
Like, nobody in their normal life is gonna read this.
It's
book.
Not the work I wanted. This is why I have a podcast. It's not for today's episode.
Right, I love it because it's accessible.
People are reading these articles that are firstly behind a paywall, or secondly in £40 books that are only published by university presses. Sorry.
And even we can't afford it.
Do you know how many books I have that I'm literally like, I'll have to wait to find it in a library and sit in the library because I don't have institutional access.
I'm telling you.
Anyway, that's the end of that. Thank you for listening, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.